to the Pink Flyer.
David Gilmour, guitariste et chef de Pink Floyd, avec Rick Wright, organiste, Roger Whipper, bassiste, et Nick Mason, batteur.
If I can remember what it was that we were going to play next, I'd tell you, but I can't.
So today I'm with member 457 of the Pink Floyd fan club, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I would have been earlier or lower number, but I was rather sort of a snobby about being a fan. You know, I actually joined because you could actually I found out you could get lots of information. You know, about gigs that were coming up or radio broadcasts. I thought, well, it would be useful. But yeah. I didn't want to, you know, because in those days, particularly a fan was somebody, you had that, there was like a girl that would be screaming at a Beatles concert, you know. So I would have been a lower number, yeah, but you're right, yes. And I've actually got the letter here somewhere from the woman who was the secretary. I think it's
Carol.
Carol, that's it, yes. Carol, yeah.
I tried to look up Carol.
Hand-typed, you know, and so welcoming me to the fan club, and yeah, it was great, yeah.
She was very diligent, was Carol, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah,
she kept people informed.
She sent, you know, really good and newsletters and things like that. It was you got things like the famous Christmas card with the signed by the Pink Floyd themselves, you know.
Yes. And one came with a little photograph of the band. Did you get that one at all?
I don't know if I got
Sid
a little...
Sid and the band.
I had a sort of brochure.
Nice.
Yeah, with Sid Barrett. Well, although they sent it to you even after he... It must have been that period where he wasn't really sure...
Crossover.
Yeah. That he'd left permanently or not. So they still used to send that out. Or maybe they had a few left over and before they did the new wave of... publicity, etc. Yeah, but
I was looking through some papers recently, old correspondence from Carol Oliver, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
yeah, from Carol, and it, of course, it had her address on it. So I thought, well, I'll look her up, see whether she's there. But the address still exists, but it's changed hands a couple of times those days. So,
and she might have got married or something, changed her
she could have.
Surname. It's difficult to trace. She might still be there. I suppose she. I don't know, obviously I never met her, and I don't know what age group she was particularly.
She's got to be your age at least.
Probably,
hasn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah.
Yes.
I thought she probably was had secretarial skills or something, because obviously it was always properly typed and it was always very efficient sort of communication.
So today in this episode, I'm speaking to Greg Taylor. We've got a lovely view out the window of the High Street, which is a very fascinating High Street in St Leonard's in Sussex. Can I call it Sussex?
Or oh, yeah, of course.
Refine it to East Sussex would be better, wouldn't it? We've nearly got a view of the sea. And later on, we're going down to the Piper Club to see Sid's floorboards. So it should be quite a generally very rather interesting day.
Yeah, we've got the...
And we've got some records around us.
With Sid's floorboards on the actual records.
I'm looking at the floorboards as we talk, yes. I'm looking at Sauce Full of Secrets, I'm looking at Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and I see the Barrett album off to my right. It's a proper tribute to all things early Floyd. And that's hugely appropriate because Greg saw the band 16 times, no fewer than 16 times.
Yeah, maybe more. There may be something that eluded me, but as far as I can remember, it was at least 16, yeah.
And was rather actively involved in some of those occasions as well.
Well, but, yes. I was so enthusiastic, you know, that I either took photographs or sometimes taped them. And it wasn't to sell it or for fame or whatever else it might have been. It was out of pure enthusiasm and just to have a record of it myself, you know, and obviously the gigs, they always played differently. It was never the same twice. So each one had its own value because of that. It was like collecting rare nuggets, wasn't it, really?
Mm. So let's go to the beginning. Where did it all begin for you, Greg?
Well, of course, I was... I've heard about the Pink Floyd. This was actually a moment of revelation. I used to stay up in London. My grandparents lived up there. And I was 15 at the time, and I'd go up there for half term or something. So I used always to go to all the trendy places, one of which was like King's Road. And I was walking down King's Road at the end of a long day, and it was about, I can always remember the time. It's just extraordinary, isn't it? About 4:45, 7:30, it was in October 1966, and there was, at World's End, and it's still there, that space, there you always used to be posters up on that particular piece of wall.
Right, events.
And there was this poster, and it, which is you're familiar with, if you would have seen, you know, obviously it's been copied and reproduced as well, of, it says, the Pink Floyd, playing at All Saints Hall in Notting Hill Gate. And it was, I thought, the Pink Floyd, that sounds like a really unusual name. They must be. And it said, with fantastic effects on it. And I thought, that also sounds really interesting. And I really seriously thought about going just to find out. But unfortunately, I lived down in Brighton area at that time on the South Coast, and I was still at school, so I couldn't nip off and get away. I couldn't have got up to London. Of course, there was money as well, would have been involved. But so I remembered their name, and I thought, I must find out more about that band, you know, the Pink Floyd.
Yes, because it was very much the at the front at the time, wasn't it?
So the next thing, that was how I did find out more about them, because obviously they weren't in any of the music papers by at that time or anything like that.
Mm.
It was that IT, International Times, was... underground newspaper that was produced at the time, you know.
Was that available in Brighton?
No, they weren't. They were in London.
Right.
But in Brighton, there was a bookshop run by a guy called Bill Butler. He was American.
Mm.
He was an American poet. And he moved down to Brighton. Perhaps the rents were cheaper as well. And he opened this bookshop selling things like the Beat Writers, like William Burroughs, you know, some poetry. Obviously a bit sort of, you know, offbeat or you know, bohemian or what, anything. And he actually stocked International Times. He was the only person in Brighton in that days. Mm. You know, it was quite sort of a new thing, wasn't it?
Mm.
And it was up to about number five, I think, International Times at that point. And so it had only been going for a few months since, I think it started in the middle of 66. And interestingly, it was I started leafing through this, and one of them had a report of the Pink Floyd playing, you know, probably in my, I don't know if it was the All Saints Hall gig or one of the early UFO gig. So I could read out more about them. So I started buying the International Times. Obviously, it was quite an extraordinary times, wasn't it? Psychedelic era beginning to emerge, you know, so you like to get into the latest thing. Mm. And so I, from then on, regularly got International Times, and they were, there were articles or reports and things they'd done over time. So eventually, through all this chain of events, we found out that they're going to have a record as well, you know.
Mm.
And that record, of course, was Arnold Lane when it did come out. And so I was a fan of the Pink Floyd before I saw them or before I heard their music.
Just from the name and from the...
Yeah, well, you've just had an instinct as well. These people are going to be something really worth...
An aura following, about that name.
Yeah, folly, you know. It was, and so I was, you know, champing at the bit, waiting for the record to come out, Arnold Lane.
Mm. Mm.
And, of course, it did.
Mm. What did you make of it?
Well, now, this is the interesting... Obviously, they played it a little bit on the radio. I think Radio London and Radio Caroline, they probably played it a bit. Mm. That's when I first heard it. Or maybe Radio Luxembourg even. I listened to it regularly, but sometimes when you were looking for something, you'd say, oh, but, you know, you'd look at all channels and see if they're... And so I heard it first on there, and I thought, firstly, I liked it. I liked the idea that it was quite an interesting weird subject. I thought, well, this is promising. But I thought, in a way, it was a little bit more... I felt they were a little bit like the Kinks or something. It was, the organ break was quite distinctive.
Yeah.
But I thought, yeah, they sound really interesting. So so I literally bought Arnold Day the day it came out. You know, when it was... this is a local record shop in Brighton. And of course... I was really great. And I looked on the back and it said Candy in a Currant Bun, you know. I thought, well, that's a strange title as well.
Yeah.
But that, to me, so I played, obviously I'd heard of Arnold Lane, but the real life changer for me, and it's a Desert Island Destiny as well, if I ever had get invited on that as well, is Candy in a Currant Bun. Because that, even now, is pretty out there, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Even all these years later, it was so... exceptional, you know, with all the electronics and all that sort of weird sort of whispering, shouting vocals. And it was just that was real pure Sid, wasn't it?
It gave you an insight into what you'd see at a concert, for example, in a way that Arnold Lane wasn't. That was just the hit single, wasn't it? Like CME Play was the hit single.
Yeah, but that, and I think sometimes people, that's true in a lot of bands, are allowed to do something that might, something might be the B-side. So it's less compromised in a way. It could be, you know, full down on the accelerator or whatever, you know, and really go. And I love that. And I probably played that side probably more than Arnold Lane. And I did play Arnold Lane. Right? But then we had to wait for any other record, didn't we? There was a bit of a wait, wasn't there?
There was, until May.
Well,
was it May? Yeah.
With C. Emily Play.
C. Emily Play, it was May, wasn't it? I just think, I've got an acetate with C. Emily Play, and that's 23rd of May, so it's always that date.
Because there was games for May earlier in the...
We'll have to have a look for the precise date in Ed Pawley's book that you've got next to you as we're talking as well, because you contributed quite significantly to that as well with your knowledge, didn't you?
Well, yes, because when it's... it's quite useful to actually have been there at the time. And I always say it's an interesting thing, seeing things in real time, you know, or try and convey what it's like to see them in real time. Because, you know, we've all seen, you know, things we discover retrospectively. You can't imagine how, what a surprise, or how sort of, how, you know, you were, you know, there was a, it was a very complicated sort of pathway. And that was part of the excitement, discovering what was coming next and how things reacted. And I think also, if you're a serious fan, in a way, I use that word rather reluctantly, but, you know, follower, if you like, there's a sort of interaction, isn't there, between the performers and the... They were certainly true with the Floyd, you know, because that group of people that supported them in London were very important, I think, as well, you know. You know, the UFO crowd or whatever, or some of the people in the art college and things like that.
So they were to come to Brighton.
Well, yeah, well, that sort of was all entwined, wasn't it? So we had
Arnold. You got the single.
You had the single. And then they were going to play in the Brighton Festival. So I thought, I've got to go to that. And that sounded extraordinary. Exciting, that did, because it was a Hornsey College of Art had the light and sound workshop there, which was, you know, really quite a progressive thing to be doing. And they were given the West Pier to curate whatever they liked, basically. So there was a ballroom and there was the main, what would have been the theatre back in the day as well, on the end of the pier. So what they did, they had a big exhibition in the what would have been the theatre. It was turned into a labyrinth of all kinetic light sculptures. Some of international artists that had done them. Anyway, it was a sort of thing. And I think there was a few people involved with Hornsey itself, Hornsey College students. And then the K4 Arena was in the ballroom, which incidentally was the same ballroom that later in the year was used to film Oh, What a Lovely War.
Right.
They create the first one, the sort of the scenes in the big scenes where they're all sort of milling about, and there's generals, you know, it's done in a very stylized sort of way. And that, you, if you ever see that film,
Same space.
It is, it's literally the same.
So quite a big space.
It was
occupied.
Well, that they built a whole sort of structure within it. So there was this old Edwardian, quite spacious ballroom, but inside they built the Kinetic Arena, as it's called. Mm. It was like 360 degree circular screen with two, at least two entrance ways, as far as I recall. Had a few, like two or three layers for seating, you know, three rows perhaps. And then a sort of area which would be a dance area.
So was it a ticketed event? Did you have to get something in advance, or could you just walk up and go in?
No, no, you had to buy it. I bought it, I think I bought it, they were selling them a, I don't know if they had a festival box office, or there was a record shop as well. They often used to sell gigs, tickets in the centre of the lanes in Brighton. So I was going to just finish the description of the arena.
Yes,
and the platform where they projected the lights from was suspended from the ceiling. So you could literally dance underneath it. So, which I don't think I've ever seen since, actually. No. That sort of idea. They must have had a quite strong scaffolding or infrastructure to support it. So that meant they could project in 3 degrees. So you could have it behind you, the lights, you could have it to one side. There are some effects that could go right round as it moved.
Okay.
And on the what you'd say was the east side was like a small stage, not very high, you know, sort of, I don't know, probably not a lot much more than over 1 foot, six, something, if that, maybe, off the ground. You know, so you're almost on the same level of the group.
You'd be winding around in the dark, would you?
You could either sit down, or you wanted to dance or stand up when the group came on, you could. Because, interestingly, you said about the ticket, the ticket, and I'd forgotten this, but actually if you look in this brochure, which this is a very rare thing I've got
my
in front
goodness,
of me.
Greg's got a brochure here.
Yes.
I could take a photograph of that later. I've never seen anything like it.
The K4, it's the catalogue, basically,
of the
Kinetic Exhibition. Look, that's what was in the theatre part.
Pictures of the lights.
These are all in black and white, sadly.
Yes.
Originally, it was like that. And it tells you some blurb of the artist. And it all folds. It's done in quite an arty way, the way it folds into. It's a silvered, which again was, you know, a bit out state-of-the-art stuff. You know.
Like a pamphlet, but far better, isn't it? I mean, that's a challenge for a printer to pull off something like that. Rusty nail, rusty staples in the middle.
It's incredibly rare.
Yeah.
It's amazingly.
Unique. Possibly.
Well, no, there are more
than there
would be, but I don't know how many have survived.
Ah, and it's also answering my question, because I was thinking, well, this is a lot to put on just for one day, but I can see here that it was the 14th, right the way through to 14th of April, that is, right the way through to the 13th of May.
Yeah, yeah, so it was there for a month.
Yes.
Was that 5 weeks? Yeah. Something like that.
Wow.
So the arena had these events, as you say. And this was obviously went to press, and it says there the Pink Floyd, but one is a list of the events that were going to happen. Les Structures Sonore were another weekend by Lazare Bachet. They were a French group that played like, there's a direct link with the Floyd here because they played Glass. They got, you knew like the idea about the wine glasses, they were going to include in one of the albums. Well, that's what Lazare Bachet did.
Oh,
I actually bought their album. I've got their album from the time.
So I often put forward this argument that everything to do with Pink Floyd starts in 1966, 1967. You just named another thing there.
That's the other interesting thing.
That starts there, doesn't it? It all comes from Sid.
Yeah, yeah.
Essentially, doesn't it? And what's going on around that time and what they're picking up and what influences they're taking.
I was saying, it was artistic and the audience. Because a lot of their audience, especially in the early days, were very creative people. So they would know things. And so it was quite interesting. But also, it doesn't say that because they'd gone to press by then, but the Soft Machine were on another weekend.
Right. Did you see that as well?
No, I didn't see that.
Oh, they would have been good.
I really regret not having. But yeah, the other thing you have to remember, and people often forget this retrospectively, is that when you're a 15-year-old, you haven't got limitless amounts of money.
No.
And I was, you know, not only was I into seeing the Pink Floyd, I was doing photography, I was buying other groups' records, I was all sorts of things. So, you the things you didn't go to, it wasn't, you know, maybe you would have gone. I did seriously cross my mind to go as well, because I was interested. I did buy some of their albums subsequently, but I never saw, well, I did see the Soft Machine, but a bit later at the, but not then, in that year.
Were you unusual for having these interests at your age at that time? Or did you go with a friend or friends?
Oh, I only went by myself to that.
To this particular
to the
event.
K4, yeah.
Yeah.
I did have my friend Bobby, Robert. Yeah, we did the light show together. I came back from seeing the Pink Floyd and said, we've got to do a light show. Because it was a revelation. Just, you know, but, you know, about, and obviously we'll talk more about that, but I, just to go back to the ticket, so we get that out of the way. Get the ticket out of the way.
Yes.
It's just, the ticket is extraordinary, isn't it? Have you seen one?
I saw one recently.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I may even have one buried somewhere. Yes. I might have kept that because I here and there I did. But it's almost chance if it's still. But also, because I got vast amounts of stuff in such total chaos, it's still a remote chance it may still exist, which I hope it is.
Tucked away somewhere safe.
I mean, yeah, look, K4. Oh. I found that 2 years ago. I didn't realise I still had it. So that was extraordinary, wasn't it?
I think it was three years ago. Yes. So you were saying inside there were banks of seats you could watch. Did you sit and watch Pink Floyd?
No, we go back to the ticket.
Yes. I'm getting excited. It's interwoven,
so it's relevant. You see, the point was that if you see here that Bruce Lacy and these humanoid robots is the consistent top act all the way through.
Mm.
So it says Bruce Lacy and his humanoid, it says that on the ticket.
Yeah.
And then the Pink Floyd is small letters underneath.
Now I've seen the robots because there's a little bit of film of them, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen that as well?
Well, the film, I might have got the collection of Bruce Lacy's works, films. BFI did a whole box set, which I've got there, over there.
Yeah. Fascinating robots.
Yeah,
they were very funny, more interesting Daleks, if you know what I mean.
They were funny because they weren't
thinner.
They were like a sort of he made it because I got to know Bruce. I worked with him. Talking about cycles in your life, I knew him quite well. I stayed in his place for about 2 or 3 weeks. Three years later, I would have never known that at that time.
Yeah.
And he was quite eccentric. He came on, as it came, the Pink Floyd weren't supporting him. He was the first performer or the first act, if you like. And he came on with his remote control, and he was wearing a sort of silvered bag, like a bin liner. It was very eccentric, Bruce.
It is April 1967, after all.
and they were quite funny. He was always quite wacky.
Bit of humour. Yeah.
Yeah. He was in a group called the Alberts.
Before them, in the early 60s,
and they did lots of retro sort of stuff, like Victorian. So one of them played a tuba and that, and he. They used to do a lot of that imitation, the wackiness of Victorian life. And then he started introducing all these funny, wacky things, little joke things. It was almost like music hall, really, in that thing. But they had, of course, the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band were very much influenced by them.
Yes.
So it was all sort of interwoven in some way.
Mm.
So, you know, that's quite an interesting thing to know about, really.
Absolutely. I can't wait any longer. I need to know about the Pink Floyd performance. Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah. Who were they? Oh, yeah, they were the main thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So Bruce went off, and there was an interval.
Yes.
And then I thought, for the band, I'm going to stand up and go straight, you know. And, of course, there were quite a lot of people there. I don't know how many. I think there was about 140 tickets, 50 tickets.
Oh, really? Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But you could move around. It wasn't so densely packed, you know, like some gigs. You can't. You're stuck at the back. You could go wherever you liked, you know. So you stood in one position, and they just came on stage, you know, in semi darkness, and And they started off with Astronomy Domini, of course, which was the first time I'd ever heard it.
Right.
Because it wasn't, yeah. they hadn't done any radio sessions. At that point, there wasn't any bootlegs of any sort, probably circulated, certainly not the Floyd. That was quite an extraordinary sort of moment because, you know how it begins. It's quite dramatic, isn't it? And suddenly the light show was just like, it was like being spun into sort of the Andromeda galaxy or something, all this, because it was going right round you. It was just like physically, so like Cinerama.
Okay, so they're in front of you, and it got it behind.
Yeah, you went like, so like the effect wasn't just, most cases it's theatrical proscenium, isn't it? Straight in front. This went right round you, so it was a sensory experience.
Yes.
And, you know, and obviously that's a very dramatic song anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, it was just, knocked out. I mean, talking about sort of a eureka moment or sort of revelation or whatever, it was that powerful. Yeah.
So they did sound in the round, but that was light in the round, wasn't it? I never really thought about that.
And I don't think I've been in a similar thing ever since, really. Certainly not with a band playing. It was so out there, so such a bold and experimental and sort of audacious thing to do. And as I say, it was very impressive, you can imagine.
So the light show, is it oil-based, like we often
say? With like the bubbles.
Look at
they look almost like stars when it sluced round, you know. I'm trying to describe
flashing
this.
Lights as well on the band.
Well, they
like did.
They had those ones on the lower level,
right?
So they flash up, which you've seen in films and things, you know. And they'd be like that. One of them would be lit up, and the other one, and because they had the distorting shadows to some degree as well, didn't they?
Behind them, just like
and because it was from
Look of the Week,
the light was beneath them. They those look quite sinister. The big sort of like hunch figures
and sort of Dracula style.
In fact, John May, he lives in Lewis now. I was talking to him when we did the show a few years ago of the, you know, the 50th anniversary of the second to last gig of Sid's second to last gig. He said when he first saw the Pink Floyd, he was frightened by them.
It could be overwhelming.
I mean, it was, you know, almost quite sinister in some ways. As you say, those images. And I was into the Velvet Underground as well. And they were very similar.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was a slightly darker. I mean, the Floyd were a bit more complex, as it turns out, you know, in terms of wasn't one take, you know, there was other sides to them, wasn't there?
Yeah, different dimensions.
But live way, it was quite loud.
And it was
physically very sort of not challenging, but, you know, it would make a very big impact. You know?
Some of the audience tapes that exist from the time, the ones later in the year, in September and November, you can barely hear the vocals. Could you hear the vocals?
Oh, of course not.
No.
But the PA systems for every band, that's another thing people don't realise.
It's a problem.
It was pretty awful for nearly every group, really, whoever they were. The Floyd had also, I mean, it's interesting looking back how I recognise certain songs afterwards, you know, that I remember seeing, because they have a certain sort of structure to the vocals, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a cut and, well, actually, it's, not cut and paste, what's the other, cut up, you know, which apparently Sid actually was influenced. So that sort of must have fed into the way he approached things. I also think, I don't want to go too much on a tangent, but I've got this idea that I think you can't make too little of the fact that Sid was fundamentally a visual artist.
Yes.
You know, people forget that. They think, oh, well, he was a pot, so I did a bit of painting. I think he thought of himself the other way around, really.
Yes, he was an artist who could
And
play
he carried
guitar.
On, didn't he, to the very end, still
that
painting.
That was what he ought to be doing.
And he used
so
what makes it interesting is that he used what would have been painterly techniques. I went to art school myself, Lisa. But, you know, but in sound, you know, he didn't follow any conventions of music as it was supposed to be. That's why I still think he was a genius, you know. Because
that's really interesting. Can you explain what you mean by that a bit more?
Well,
painterly instincts in sound.
Well, as I say, sometimes with a visual, you can put two unrelated images together that don't follow a logic.
So two sounds.
For example, and you might, you know, in some abstract expressionism, they'll sort of throw paint on a canvas and then maybe reorder it in some way. I mean, I'm just saying that it was you would go into contrasts and things. You see things in different perspectives. You know, it's not like. I think some more sort of what is conventional music has more of a sort of a certain sort of plot. It exists on one plane, if you like.
You know the plot. There's a structure there, whereas perhaps less.
Hmm?
There's a plot and a structure with conventional music.
Yeah, too.
It's much less predictable.
No. And the crucial thing about Sid was that he didn't like rules. Which is why I really identified with him as well.
Yeah.
Because someone, I'll do this. Well, who says you can't do this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, why can't we put sounds of ducks or something going quack, 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 quack.
Indeed,
Or whatever it might be.
Yes.
And he would always come up with the left of central idea. I think, I don't know, I was never with the Floyd, but I was felt in many ways they were running to keep up with him all the time.
I was going to say, did Sid feel like the leader?
Well, he was so artistic, there's no doubt about it.
But visually, was he the leader as well? I mean,
that's their paradox.
They looked like equals.
It was all sort of underplayed, wasn't it? I mean, a lot of people didn't know what they looked like, did they, for years?
No.
So it goes, because they were always playing in this confusing dark, semi-darkness with flashing lights. The only person that spoke, of course, was Roger. He announced between
kids.
He was always the only one that spoke. Nobody else ever spoke, did they? Certainly not in the early days.
No, it was a rarity. And when you hear it on audience tapes, when Gilmore talks later on, it's almost as though he's being a bit naughty speaking up there, because that's what Roger does.
Yeah,
back off, Gilmore.
No, it was. I mean, he was definitely the one that introduced things all the way along. Certainly. Through, well, as we know, I mean, he's not backwards and coming forwards, is he? And he did all the interviews, nearly all the interviews at one point, didn't he?
It was
largely him that was speaking.
Do you recall what they were wearing? Funny question. Do you recall what the band were wearing?
Yeah, well, I'm Sid was wearing some sort of, I might have been satin. As far as my memory, exists. It was a sort of creamy satin, sort of piratey type shirt, you know, and velvet trousers.
Right.
But not blue velvet.
No.
Red velvet trousers. He concentrated on playing and singing. He didn't interact with the audience. Was he quite shy, really? I don't know. Right. That was the impression.
Focused on his music.
Yeah.
So he wasn't animated on stage.
No, it was always impassive, really, in my experience. But that was almost a Warholian thing, wasn't it? It was quite, in a way, that was okay then, in a sort of avant-garde group, is to be, not to be wanting the audience to be too receptive or, you know, caring what the audience thought or whatever.
Yeah.
It's quite complicated to think about, but yeah.
Yeah, people didn't appreciate overplaying in that way, I suppose, did they?
Yeah. Well, like the lead guitar solo or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Well, we had Hendrix doing that, obviously.
Because they did a tour with him, didn't they? Which I saw them on as well. That was quite a contrast. But, different. Although they'd started off as a rhythm and blues band, they've soon gone way beyond that. It was probably one of those inspirational things you can't completely explain. My feeling is that Sid was being such a creative person that it was like the runaway train, really. He had so many really amazing ideas, and he said some people reckon he was a bit like, I think Dougie Field said that he was like a toothpaste or tube of paint, you know, you squeeze it all out. And he squeezed out all that amazing creative potential and you know, mental energy and in a relatively short period of time.
Very short period of time, yeah.
I mean, it is extraordinary to think he'd come and gone in the band within, you know, in their public life.
Within a year.
Yeah, yeah. And if anything, in some ways, he was already sort of half going about after 6 months or 4 or 5 months.
And
you know, in 67, in the year of the 67.
The more we reflect on the interviews from that time in books like Ed's, you can see that overwhelmingly that he was already checking out by the summer. It was. It had gone beyond.
I saw them a few times at the. I saw them more at the end of the year. There was a little bit of a gap when I didn't get to see them in the summer. But I look back and I find that they were. I couldn't have seen them because they were too far away, either abroad or up north or something. And I missed.
And they travelled a lot, didn't they?
Well, I think that was another thing that broke him, wasn't it?
Yeah,
he was not. The others, I'll tell you later on possibly, but the others I always think were a totally different character in general. Mm. They came from different sort of backgrounds.
Stock.
And well, not backgrounds, they came from a different metal, you know, to physically and mentally probably. And they were suited, obviously, for their big careers they had afterwards, for what they did, you know. Mm.
So you were hooked. Impressed.
Well, I was going to say there were other numbers I remember from the gig.
Mm.
Matilda Mother, I was saying about the shaping of the vocals. Now, that was very distinctive there because obviously Rick Wright actually sung some of it and he was playing the organ and I was standing next to him. And I've got a very distinct memory of watching Rick Wright sing, you know, the lines he sings from Matilda Mother. And he was wearing a little shirt with little tiny paisley type flowers on it, because I was literally standing like 4 or 3 feet away. I mean, it was easy. I mean, I could, you know.
Gosh.
Funny,
we need a camera inside your memory at the
with the brain cells could be extracted.
Yeah.
And there's this moment when there was a blue splurge for the light show, liquid light show that went right across him, you know, like someone had thrown a giant pot of paint over him or something, you know, very intense images because the projectors were literally weren't that far away. They were only about sort of 25 feet away or something.
Okay.
So you've got, especially with those 1,000-watt bulbs, it was very intense. It wasn't just like something just floating over. It was sort of, it was like they were taken over by it in a way.
So, excuse my naive question, but the projectors, 25 foot, 30 foot away, they're above them.
It's
all angling down.
Basically. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then they're also managing to go round the room as well, you said. Is it as though they were rotating the projections in order to cover all the surfaces?
They may have had, as it appears, they might have had two with the same effect on.
It
goes zoom, dum, dum.
Yes.
And they obviously planned certain things. I'm just thinking, back in my memory, you know, because obviously I haven't done light shows myself.
I was about to say, you would understand how you might.
But of course, that would have been a demanding thing, because normally you would just, you know, you've got, just straight in front of you, maybe sort of, I don't know, 45 degrees at the most, not 100, 360.
Do you remember any of the other songs they played?
Lucifer's Sound, I'm sure they played, yeah, because that riff is very distinctive. I think that was like second or third, like it is on the album. That was fairly early on. And also I remember that, probably that's why I remember it in some ways, because I was standing underneath the platform of the projection, back platform, and there were, of course, this is the other thing I was saying about the fan base. There was a lot of people that had come down from London, the latest...
Made the journey.
Yeah, the latest, hippest, trendiest people.
Mm.
And they looked different as well, you know, because they were wearing the girls were wearing maybe Indian dresses and ethnic jewellery and people had bells and, you know, and velvet jackets. You know, they were a lot different to what you would have seen, even in Brighton, which is a little bit... hipper, always has been, but it was a notice code, and you could smell you could smell hashish as well, like the sweet smell of
hashish. Really quite exotic feeling.
Women of that hadn't counted down either. Yes. You know, they'd been, obviously they smoked a bit of that. And you know, and some of the girls, I remember this girl with the, right in this Indian dressing, and she, so the smell of jasmine wafted across as well. A very sensory experience every way. And of course, you could almost hear close by the jangling of the bells as they were dancing in time. So a very strong riff like Lucifer Sam, you know, and there's that great sequence, which of course they extended everything as they always did. Yeah. It wasn't just it's like the short version you see on the or hear on the album or on a single. And so I'm sure that was probably what they were dancing to then, yeah.
Interstellar Overdrive, and
And maybe, because not, I can realize it was quite an overwhelming experience. So you get sort of vignettes or the odd snapshots that you remember certain things, but I wouldn't have been surprised if they'd use one or two, cosmic or sort of astronomical illusions and that light show, you know. I did myself when I did then later on. I got, you know, as I say, if you could go in a time machine, but it was amazing. It was like a tsunami of sensory experiences. And you couldn't, you know, especially even if you were open to it, you couldn't imagine. You know, it's difficult to describe, especially people are less visually sophisticated now as well. I mean, then rather than now, because it was the other way. You know, that's the other thing about the context. You know, that weird sound, those amazing images, that things they'd never, ever seen before. Mm. When I started doing a light show with a local group, even 2 years later, I remember doing, we used to go to like local villages and things, you know. And it was like going to an African village or something. Yeah. You were like magicians or godlike.
Exposing them to madness.
Open-mouthed. You cannot imagine that sort of the impact. As I say, it's difficult to imagine retrospectively now because things that everybody's just blasé about everything, aren't they, really?
Yeah. Goodness me. It must have been just so extraordinary.
Well, I said for me, it was a life-changing experience. It was a revelation, really, literally. I will say it did change my life because I wanted to go to art school before that. I was wanted to be a graphic designer. I thought because I was quite into advertising and I still find that quite interesting.
You could have been an album cover designer or something like that.
Well, perhaps. Yeah, I liked advertising because I'm also interested in the language, and that's how. I mean, I won't digress now, famously as I do, but, you know, I ended up in this group, Coon Transmissions, and Foxtrot Echo was my identity in that group. And some of my advertising interests or inclinations were sort of perverted or distorted or used in that in another way. So it was quite... I'm still interested in graphics. Like, what one to say? I've got this new, fantastic, stunning new medium. I eventually did go to art school, I was still too far ahead. They didn't have any courses in it.
No.
So I did a foundation year at St Martin's in London. And then there weren't any other courses to go on to because they didn't exist.
Nobody had thought of it yet.
No. Although we were supposed to be creative, not that creative.
Yes. There are limits.
You had to stick to painting or sculpture. You had to stick to a specific category. Yeah. Of course, it's changed subsequently. But then it was a different world. But as I say, we just started doing the light show after that. I'd done with my friend. And so we borrowed the school geography master's oldest 1,000, tutor 1,000, which it was the same sort of projector used at schools and universities at the time. And the Floyd used in their light show, you know, 1,000. Well, they had an example in the exhibition at the V&A, you know, on the Floyd.
Yeah. It was good to see that part of it, wasn't it? I took a picture of that.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So we one stagger out onto the...
I was going to say, what do you do at the end of that? Out into the...
It's a sort of, you know, normal stunned
world.
Is the word.
Yes.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, dazed and confused, possibly.
Yeah.
But And it was, Sid became my hero. So he was like an icon of, symbolic of wayward creativity. And I mean, he should be a saint. Perhaps they'll canonize him. Saint of creativity or whatever. I mean, obviously he paid the price in some ways, which has became part of the fascination people had with him, like all those romantic poets, you know.
Yeah, he's like young Wordsworth or something like that at that point, isn't he? Was at his peak.
Well, yeah, it's probably Byron-esque, isn't he? Well, he looked more like Byron, didn't he, with curly hair.
And his pirate style shirt.
But he was quite literary as well, Sid, wasn't he? Mm. Which is quite interesting. He was quite well read. He made loads of references, obviously, in a lot of their work.
Lyrics and so on, not least Piper at the Gates of Dawn. So it took until September for you to see them again because of circumstances.
Yeah, because what I alluded to earlier, there was a gap probably because I think in retrospect you think, why didn't I see them? But they didn't play locally.
Yeah.
And there weren't any festivals in those days, you see. Sometimes in the summer, you got to see people later on, a few years later. Mm. You would have seen, I did see the Floyd, as you would get round to, in a festival. So the next time was in Worthing.
Yeah, 21st of September at the Assembly Hall.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that building. I've never been there.
Well, it's a sort of 1930s, I think it was built in the 1930s, a sort of a... solid sort of angular sort of building, and we lived sort of east of Brighton, so we had to quite an effort to get there. I think we had to get two buses or.
So you're talking we now. So you didn't go to this one.
One was with my friend Bobby.
Yeah.
Who was now we were doing the light show together. Mm. He was a big Hendrix fan, and he actually. He was onto Hendrix, but I found the Floyd and he found Hendrix, in our personal world.
Yeah, perfect for later in the year, but at this point. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So he heard about it through another friend. They heard that this new guy from America, Hendrix, playing in Worthing in January, 67. And he went off to see that, and he came back raving about how fantastic it was. Mm. And I don't know if he had aged you out by then or not, but... He was just very much new on the scene. We both went to Worthing. But I said, again, it was a big effort. The other thing it wasn't like getting in your car and driving off like you would now. When you're younger, you know, it took, and then when it finished, you have to catch a last boat.
Yeah.
You know? Sometimes we had to walk back.
Right.
After we saw Hendrix at the university, we had to walk 5 miles home because... We couldn't get back any other way because it was too late to get, but it was worth it.
It's worth it, yeah, undoubtedly.
So I want to tell you about.
Yeah, so you're in this 1930s building this time. Quite a contrast, I can imagine, on the pier.
Yeah, well, the pier was like the best ever gig ever.
Yeah.
I don't know how you say it. But so I... By then, of course, they were quite popular because they'd had See Emily play out and lots more people would.
Piper at the Gates of Dawn was
out. So we got there and we made a point of being really close to the stage and you had to stand for a while to make sure you were near them, you know, that sort of. Mm. And I put myself directly in front of Sid.
So how tall is the stage? Is the stage...
That was quite high, that one.
Quite high.
I don't know. Higher, it was more of a sort of
shoulder
conventional...
Shoulder height to you?
4 feet, you know.
It's
sort of conventional theatre stage height, I suppose. So I was in a very good position. So I was literally about 5 feet away from Sid Barrett.
Wow.
When he came on stage.
You lined yourself up perfectly.
Yeah, what happened in the meantime, mostly they got a business, you know, got some success with See Emily play. So what was good there was that they'd been able to afford new equipment.
Watkins
Watkins and all these big, large PA speakers and that. The trouble was it was so bloody loud. It was so really loud that in a way you couldn't quite hear what was...
You didn't need to be at the front for those purposes.
Obviously it made it even worse.
Yeah.
I mean, what I have to say I had to do is in order to hear the words... that they were singing, you had to put both your palms up against your ears and press them really hard.
Right.
And then you might stand a chance of being able to hear some of the vocals, because the rush of sound for that volume of stuff, and everybody got so taken away. They're all over turning all the volumes up. Everybody, was it the Cream, were doing that. Now they could do it. Before they couldn't. They went rather overdid it, you know.
Yeah.
Made a load of people go deaf, probably.
Probably, yeah. Tinnitus later on.
And so they played the sort of the songs you would expect them to play. You know? They didn't usually play their singles, of course, as we know. So it would be Interstellar Overdrive. But what was very odd this time was that Sid wasn't. I didn't see him sing.
Right.
He was playing. He was standing in front of the microphone, like a not a marionette, but he was like standing there. He was actually playing.
Okay.
But he
played his part.
But he was looking unblinking straight into this sort of spotlight or whatever the light was.
Right.
You know, I did actually do some drawings, inspired by him afterwards, you know, because it was such an extraordinary sort of experience, because he didn't seem to be blinking. Perhaps he was tripping, I'm sure he was.
Yeah.
But it was seen almost beyond that as well. He was playing like, you know, not always a robotic fashion, but sort of like, you know, up, down, you know.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, he was basically a rhythm guitarist. Yeah.
And quite still as well. He wasn't jumping on the spot or anything like that.
No, he didn't move hardly at all. He just sort of be rooted to the spot.
Because I've seen him playing in that style with, like you're describing, with the sort of like up, down style, and some UFO footage, which hasn't done the rounds yet. But at the same time, he's also jumping with it. So it's as though that's how he
was a bit more animated. Well, I don't think he was on that occasion.
No,
I think they were having.
He's looking into the distance. He's.
I think the date of that is September, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
I think they were beginning to have trouble with him. Probably
21st of September. I mean, we've got the audience recording from the 13th of September, and that's pretty good.
Well, he's played everything.
He's pretty. Yeah.
Well, I think he probably must have been playing that to some degree. As I say, it was exacerbated by the fact that the volume was so much. You couldn't hear what it was a lot of the time. So it's like, sort of like you like a sea of sound, if you like. But I do remember particularly that gig was when they did, because Roger was making announcements between each song.
Mm.
And then he said, this is a song about a dead person.
Ah.
And then it was they were playing
Old Woman with a Casket.
They were playing Scream the Last Scream. With the casket. Yeah, and what was although apparently, because Sid actually sings on the recorded versions of that, and he did on what's her name, Top Gear. He didn't sing there. That on that occasion, it was the vocals were between. Mostly between Roger and Rick.
Right.
And but I think what's his name was supposed to sing. Nick Mason. Nick Mason was supposed to sing it, wasn't he? On the original concept of the album. But
that's not while he's drumming at the same time.
Yeah. So probably live, he can't do that.
Yeah.
So they had to sing it, you know. And so, but Sid didn't play. He did play, but he didn't. Well, who knows what he played? Maybe he was playing the same note. Maybe they thought, oh God, you know, there was too many variables, so we better, they prepared it that way. He didn't like, he just stopped singing when he was supposed to be singing. He just wasn't, they thought he's not going to do it, so we'll have an alternative, you know. That's my theory anyway. Yeah.
And you had to have your hands over your ears in order
I did, and I listened to the words.
Words.
Because I thought, well, this is because I was into the idea of the song. It sounded really interesting because we hadn't heard about much new material.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we'd had Piper come out, but then we'd heard some of those tracks as well on Top Gear and things, and so there was less surprises. But the fact there was going to be a new phase was particularly intriguing.
Yes, material for the next album, perhaps.
or the next single, because that was the big question. They weren't, because they hadn't TM Le Pay had come out.
That
was before they were looking for a single, weren't they? At that time in September. But I see that big thing that stays to my memory in that gig was Sid's sort of the infinite sort of black hole of his eyes, which obviously gets. I got rather obsessed with it, you know, myself. And funnily enough, it came like two dark holes in the sky or whatever.
Yeah.
It got referenced later on as well. But I remember having that reaction myself.
You certainly weren't the only person to observe it, were you?
Oh, yeah. But I've got it. I can prove what I said as well, because I've got some periods. Sketchbooks from back there, with still of my
You've
own.
Got those.
I'm not making it up retrospectively.
No, absolutely not. Wow. Well, we're getting ahead at quite a pace here. Should we go on to the next concert?
Yeah, if you like.
Yes, it's not long afterwards. That was the 6th of October. So only a few weeks later, you were at Miss Teenage Brighton contest.
Oh, yeah.
Which makes me feel like there was young women walking around in bikinis.
Of course. Interesting combination. Well, it was. I think it was done for a local charity somehow at the King's West Centre. And in those days, they used the top rank was in the. They got rid of it subsequently, years later. But they used to have it was like in a big arena, and there was a second sort of like a circle around the top, which is incidentally where the light show Wayne Wilson. Was projecting from.
Is this a daytime concert?
It's early evening.
It's an early evening.
And I've showed you a ticket before, haven't I? Do you remember one torn in half?
I think you did, yes.
Yeah, and I think it's probably unique, this ticket, because it was an old school doorman, and as we went in, he literally tore one half the ticket away and threw it in a dustbin.
We'd want that dustbin
and I kept
now,
my half because... Yes. I was such a dedicated follower. But most people probably threw theirs. Oh, it's torn in half and throw it away.
Useless by that stage.
And luckily, my bit's got all the essential details on it as well. But it was done, and there were so when you went. So the evening was basically every gig there. This was just quite bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah.
There was a Sid Dean band. They had a sort of long term contract. They were like a conventional dance band, old school dance band. You would have done the foxtrot and the cha-cha or whatever. And there was about 16 of them. And they do the first set. They were like the support band, these guys in sort of these tuxedos and saxophones and stuff.
Yeah.
And there was a group as well. It was a local group that I think they played.
Omega Plus.
Yes. I don't remember them, and of course I think I can't remember whether or not the Miss Teenage Brighton happened. It happened before they played,
right?
And they obviously Rick was one of the judges.
Yeah,
he must have taken the short straw. Well, Sid definitely wasn't going to do it. And Roger probably thought, I'm not going to be doing
not
that.
I'm going to lower myself
because being the Marxist he was, even in those days, because he must have been because his Jude was in the Revolutionary Communist Party, wasn't she?
Yeah.
I think it was at the Workers' Revolutionary Party. So one of those extreme left.
Sounds like a Monty Python film, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it almost was. Anyway, so they had the Miss Teenage Brighton contest, and all these girls with bikinis coming and parading along the stage. Mm. One of whom I knew, I was at school with, Sandy Straw, her name was.
Ah.
And she did a few, she used to enter a few of these. She ended up later in life running a fancy dress costume shop in the centre of Brighton, in the North Lanes in Brighton. I talked to her about the old days once or twice. I haven't seen her for a long time now, but she was one of the contestants. And anyway, I think she came third or fourth or something.
Oh, well, at least she wasn't last.
No, but on that one, I think she managed to win one or two. And then when the winner was there, because Rick got a kiss from the winner, didn't he? And I think he may have got a kiss from the runner up. And you know, he's groupies. Quite a shy guy, really, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, I couldn't, you couldn't imagine him throwing himself.
And then,
into
of course,
that.
We went into the actual set. You know, the band started playing, and I was quite far away on that occasion because I was up in the circle. It was quite busy. It was quite a lot of people anyway. But I was, because I was into the light show, I thought this is an unusual opportunity. I could go and see how he does it.
Right.
So I was standing next to Wynne Wilson, watching how he did it, the business with, he had two Audis projectors and this sandwich of various oil liquids and in a blowtorch. And he'd, through the fire regulation.
I was going to say, pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
But he knew what he was doing.
To make it, warm it up every now and then, so they jumped about a bit.
Yeah.
And then obviously they would have had, I think they had their things on the stage as well.
Was it a revolving stage?
Yeah. Because they came round, like in
London Palladium.
Yeah. That was the other funny characteristic. I mean, it was so, that's a very memorable gig because it was so bizarre.
Yeah.
And I have never met anybody else that remembers being there so far.
No.
But it was certainly one. But the other thing about the music, of course, was that because it was such a poppy thing, they really must have been browbeaten into actually doing their singles, you see.
Oh, I see, yeah.
They certainly did See Emily Play, which I only ever heard once in any of the times I saw them.
Yeah.
They didn't like to do that, did they?
No, not their thing. But I suppose they...
They could do it, because we've heard other long, extended versions, but not many.
It must have been
rare.
A reluctant playing to the fans and
reluctant
gig all round. Doesn't really sound like their scene at all, does it?
No. Because it was very... they were doing loads of untypical gigs, weren't they, in 1967? And some of them must have been terrible. I mean, they were okay if they were an art college or a university or something, but having to go and play in some rugby club or something like that, they did one or two really extreme things up north, didn't they?
And they got stuff chucked at them and so on. So you recall them playing the singles. Did they play Astronomy, Domine and Interstellar?
Oh, yeah, I think they nearly always did, didn't they? They're staple for... forever, really. I mean, they even did it in latter days, didn't they, in the 90s.
So I'm imagining Miss Teenage Brighton attracting quite a lot of sensible local people who want to see how their daughter, their niece and so on is going to get
been,
on an occasion like this. Not a typical Floyd audience.
Probably not.
Not like you were describing on the West Pier.
I think it was much more of a general audience, you know, probably in that sense. I mean, there would have been people, and there would probably be snobby students that wouldn't go to the top ranked suite in there, because you know, most of the time they'd be
not cool enough.
It wouldn't, you know. Mm. But again, it's just the social order of, you know, the divisions and things. That, again, is another thing that one forgets about, you know, years later. But it's something to think about, as you suggest.
Yeah, might have been a bit strange compared to the other gigs. And the next one you saw, because we're still in 67 here.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Is the Hendrix tour.
Oh, yeah. So, well, we're very, very much looking forward to that. You can imagine, it's a fantastic bill, wasn't it? For 12 and 6, which is, I looked it up, and it's still cheap.
Yeah.
Sounds ridiculous now, doesn't it? 60p or something.
Yeah.
But it's not really 60p. But even in contemporary terms, it's £18 to see Jimi Hendrix, Pink Floyd, Move, The Nice. What was it? Ira Parent and was it Outer Limits? Or something?
Yeah.
I think.
Just about everybody you could hope to see on a night.
I mean, how could they? And they did two shows as well.
Yeah. And you were at the second show.
The second. I think we had a choice and we thought, well, let's go. It's going to be the climax, isn't it? It seems a bit wrong if it's going to be another one after it. You know.
And this was at the Dome.
Yeah, which was a place that Floyd visited many times.
Yeah, they kept going back, didn't they?
In fact, I saw Nick Mason's band there
a few
years ago. Yeah. Again, just to compare. And they said on the last time we. He played here, Nick played here, and it was probably back in the 70s.
Yeah,
they were too big after that, weren't they?
Yeah, 72. So just three songs, Interstellar Overdrive, Set the Controls, and Power Talk H.
Yeah, well, that obviously, I've got a photograph of him playing, as Syd Barrett playing at that one.
This is where my jaw drops.
Yeah, and he was wearing a green shirt, by the way.
Is this your first Syd photograph that you took? Had you taken one before that?
Well, no.
You didn't obviously have a camera back in
April.
Well, no,
it wouldn't have worked. It was like taking the photograph in the dark, wasn't it?
It was.
The lights were flashed.
You could have taken a black and white shot, perhaps.
And for my friend had his camera, you see, and we shared that. And he took some of them, and I took some of them.
And this,
although I was into photography, I think it didn't occur to me to take my camera because I knew, normally speaking, it would be hopeless, you know. Because especially, but he didn't think like that, and you can't really take a flash.
Is Bobby you're talking about, is it?
Bobby. Yeah,
so
yeah,
Bobby and you shared a camera.
Instamatic, you see.
So quite a basic camera.
Yeah, amazingly, he got some reasonable photos. In fact, there were other ones of the Floyd, which have gone astray, which is tragic, because one of them was a really good image as well, of the light show with, like, Roger Waters hunched over with a big distorted shadow.
Just to catch on that, you've got one photo of...
That seems to be one of at the moment.
Unpublished, I think, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Have you got it here?
No, I haven't because I can't find it again. But it'll be in a file. It's a certain section of my memorabilia that's all mixed up because I moved, as I've probably explained to you about
keep
three or four times.
In storage, don't you?
Not through my choice, so. Things, you know, is it here and there, you know? A lot of things are kept, but I can see it in my mind's eye. But it would be somewhere relatively safe.
I think people would love to see that picture.
He's sort of standing, again, looking down, and his hair is slightly... You know, there's some story about him having his hair, him putting mandrax paste on his hair.
And all of that.
But his hair does almost... It's more sort of flattened down, and it... And it's not like the sort of Afro-y style hairstyle. It's more flattened down even at that gig.
Yeah.
Perhaps he had a thing. And I think they just did those three numbers, as you say. And of course, why they did those, because they only had a short set, didn't they? It was only 20 minutes or something.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it was because there was all the other bands, 24. So they did Astronomy, Domini, and because Roger Waters sang... set the controls, and I think they could limp through, if Syd decided not to play, they could limp through them and still get away with it, with the organ and the bass guitar and the drums. Because obviously
the
Nice were basically that, weren't they?
Yeah.
So, but anything else that required his vocals or anything too complicated, they had to avoid, so they stuck with those.
So there's a light show.
There was that great image, and they must have been from the circle. We were down in the, that's the other point, we were down in the stalls.
Yeah.
About, I think, row 12, 8, 10, 12, something like that.
Have you got the ticket?
I don't know.
Did you buy the programme?
It may turn up as well, another thing.
Yeah.
There's a few things that have been filed away somewhere so safe you can't find them again.
Need to be preserved, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, my friend Bobby, when we left, he, because obviously Hendrix was on the bill as well. It was a fantastic evening, you can mention. He got the poster from the thing outside. It was a cabinet and it didn't have any glass in it. So next time we took it back on the bus, in the back of, you know, the big full format poster. You usually only see the handbills, don't you?
Yeah.
And it still exists because his son's got it and he...
Has Bobby kept his stuff like you've kept your stuff?
Well, yeah, it's Hendrix things.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Has he got Floyd stuff or is it just Hendrix stuff?
Well, he had the odd photos, but he didn't see them as many times as me.
No.
And as I said, we had a... And I don't think he got to see Hendrix that many times because he was doing all these American tours and stuff afterwards. Mm. He hardly was... And he came... And then he got a job and, you know... Mm. And he did work abroad for a while, so... Sadly for him, I don't know if he got to see his big hero again.
So, still a great impression being made. But you made an interesting point about, in September, obviously Syd looking off into the distance and
Well, look, straightforward, yeah.
Yeah. The
to eternity,
the staring eyes. Did you sense that he was any better when you saw him at the Hendrix tour, or about the same?
As I say, he was always slightly withdrawn, but he was sort of always looked like he was looking at the floor, right?
Yeah.
And sort of just looking at his guitar like that. If you see the photograph, he's just... He was pretty much like that all evening. It wasn't like he had different positions, you know. So I only took, I took that one, you know, because we shared the camera. You know, I only took that one. I thought there's no point training another one because it'll be exactly the same. It'll just be.
Do you remember feeling concerned about Sid at the time?
Oh, yeah. I think there were rumours beginning to. Well, there were certainly about that tour.
Wasn't because, there?
No.
There was reports in the press about them having to have a break due to nervous exhaustion and the like, but as somebody going to the gigs, did you feel a sense of anticipation, thinking, I wonder how Sid's going to be at this gig?
Well, So, I mean, there was that. I said there were, because there had been that story about Davey O. List having to deputise for them in Liverpool, wasn't it, or something? I was wondering, would he be there at all? And in a way, he was, but he wasn't, you know, probably. Because, again, with the sound, I mean, can we hear a guitar? Can we not hear a guitar?
Yeah. We've been so loud. Was it as loud as
it wasn't as
previous
loud,
concerts.
But it was loud enough, probably. Yeah. And because it was a big sensory assault, the Floyd performance always, with the light show and that. It's not like when you've got, that's your sole focus when you just look at the group and you can hear the sound. When it's all these weird visuals going on there.
It's all going on.
So you get to respond to the shape of the number, you know, or the piece of music.
19th of January, 1968.
Oh, yeah.
It's your five-man concert.